Owned Grey Power is pleased to sponsor this edition of Senior Focus.
Well, good day to you. This is Richard Barter here again to talk on the Senior Focus time about transport. This week I came across an article written by Jonathan English, and it's a recent article, just a couple of weeks ago, and what it's called is The Commuting Principle That Shaped Urban History. Now, not all of you might be commuting these days, but what is interesting is that it is the commuters that have shaped our cities over the years. That task of going from home to a place of work. And typically, that place of work has been in the centre of town or city. I'm fortunate enough to work from home, and so these things don't really apply to me. And I imagine for many of you, you may not be having to do that daily trip in and out of town. But from ancient Rome to modern Atlanta, the shape of cities has been defined by the technology that allowed commuters to get to work in around 30 minutes. How's that? In 1994, Cesare Machetti, an Italian physicist, described an idea that has become known as the Machetti constant. In general, he declared that people have always been willing to commute for about half an hour one way from their homes each day. Now, this principle has a profound implication for urban life. The value of land is governed by its accessibility, which is to say, by the reasonable speed of transport to reach it. Even if there's a vast amount of land available in the country, that land has no value in an urban context unless transportation makes it quickly accessible to the urban core. Some of you who live in and around Auckland will have heard this raised quite a bit recently over the expansion south and north and west of Auckland, and people talking about the lack of infrastructure to these new suburbs, and particularly the transport infrastructure. Now, this pattern has repeated itself again and again as new mobility modes, that's new ways of getting around, have appeared. This means that if the physical size of a city is a function of the speed of transportation technologies that are available, and as speed increases, cities can occupy more land, bringing down the price of land and therefore of housing in the newly accessed territory. Now, we're going to give a few examples of American and European cities in this next little bit, but I have been looking at some of the history of New Zealand, and particularly in the ways people travelled over the years. And while our history matches more closely to perhaps the USA in terms of how long we've had European settlement anyway, it's very similar. We just tend to be a few years behind where these examples come from. So they gave an example of Atlanta, and it may bear, while it bears little resemblance to the cities a thousand or so years ago, its current residents share something fundamental with those people of the distant past. The average one-way commute time in metropolitan areas today is around 26 minutes. While that figure varies from city to city and from person to person, some places have significant numbers of workers who enjoy particularly short or long commutes, and some are willing to travel for longer than that. But the endurance of this Machetti constant has profound implications for urban life. And as we said before, it means the average speed of our transportation technology does more than anything to shape the physical structure of our cities. Let's see how. Let's travel back in time more than 2,000 years and move towards the present. This journey will take a little less than 30 minutes. Back around 800 BC to 1700 AD, that's before the Industrial Revolution, pretty much the only way people for most places on dry land to get around was on foot. With services centred or concentrated in the centre of cities, the radius of development from the heart of the city was limited to not much more than 1 mile or 1.6 kilometres, which is about the distance a person can walk in 30 minutes. Sure enough, most cities from the ancient times to the Industrial Revolution did not grow much bigger than a 2 mile diameter. The core areas were often even smaller, though some of the poor lived in settlements outside the city gates. Ancient Rome packed as many as 1 million people into an area little more than 2 miles in diameter. That's a little under 4 kilometres. Medieval Paris stretched only about 2 miles from the Bastille to the Louvre. Vienna's Innenstadt measures only 1 mile in diameter, and the historic city of London is nicknamed the Square Mile for a reason. Beijing's walls enclosed an inner city about 3 miles in diameter, right into the 20th century, and that still made up most of the developed areas. So as these old cities grew, they became denser. The narrow warrens of surviving European medieval cities like Florence, Prague, or a few parts of Paris untouched give one a good idea of this process. The arrival of horse-drawn mass transportation, which weren't, in a sense, the first fixed bus routes, were created in Paris in 1662. But these didn't change the pattern. The hooves didn't get people around much faster than people's feet did. For most residents, the cities of this era were awful places to live, with extreme crowding, dismal sanitation, and routine outbreaks of vicious diseases. Apartments may seem livable when occupied by a couple with an air conditioner to the window, but in those days, they weren't so pleasant when occupied by eight to a room. The idea of escaping the city to the countryside is therefore as old as the city itself. Aristocrats kept country estates and villas for thousands of years. But even for the wealthiest, the long-distance travel was an uncomfortable exercise, involving days on a horse or in a carriage on a rutty road. When Louis XIV centralised the French nobility in Versailles, he could be sure that their visits to their domains would be infrequent, and that served his goal of limiting their power. For the aristocracy of the pre-industrial age, commuting from a rural estate to a job in the city wasn't possible on a daily basis. But such people did not tend to have what modern people would consider to be normal jobs. By the 19th century, the mercantile elite could not afford to be too distant from their urban enterprises. Invention quickly followed, which allowed a privileged few an escape. Now we're going to listen to a piece of music I think aptly named Hit the Road by Ray Charles.
Oh, I guess if you said so, I then I have to pack my things and go.
The first big change happened between the 1840s and the 1950s. In 1830, a British civil engineer, George Stephenson, opened the first steam-powered public railway between Manchester and Liverpool. Soon, railways focused as much on what they call proto-commuters as they did on intercity travellers. The London and Greenwich Railway opened up in 1836 and new lines quickly began radiating out of central London. Cities across Europe and the United States soon followed. In London, the Industrial Revolution was the first time in human history that transportation was no longer limited to human and animal power. Railways enabled relatively affluent people to live in lower density settlements on the urban fringe, or in towns outside the city and take the train into work. But steam trains couldn't stop very frequently because of their slow acceleration, and they were comparatively expensive. Once in motion, they could move a passenger at an unprecedented rate, though, 10 miles or more in half an hour. There's that half an hour figure. Instead of gradually extending the city, they created little villages around their stations a couple of miles apart, railroad suburbs. Because access to the city was expensive, they were limited to all but the very wealthy and those who served them. The upper middle class lived within walking distance of the station, and the truly rich lived on estates a short coach ride a day away. Today, many of these villages remain enclaves of affluence. The mainline suburbs of Philadelphia, Scarsdale near New York, Brooklyn near Boston, the Stockbroker Belt west of London, and Saint-Germain near Paris are excellent examples. America's railroad city, Chicago, spawned several of the most legendary railroad suburbs such as Evanston, Oak Park and Lake Forest. But for the urban masses, a different mobility technology would be needed. The horse-drawn omnibuses or horse cars would not cut it. Thousands of workhorses pulling hundreds of wagons around the city created serious environmental hazard, as the piles of manure on the street could literally be as high as the people walking past. So, between the 1880s and the 1950s, the invention of bicycles and electric streetcars provide such an alternative. A safety bicycle, which began supplanting the towering high-wheelers in 1885, allowed any reasonably physically fit person to travel considerably faster than on foot. The first electric streetcar system entered service in 1888 in Richmond, Virginia, and the technology spread at the speed of electricity. Now, electrification happened in New Zealand in the early 1900s, and the first electric system to operate was in Auckland in 1902. So you see, we're a little bit late, a little bit behind. This was followed by Dunedin in 1903, Wellington in 1904, and Christchurch 1905. By 1916, electric trains were also operating in Whanganui, Invercargill, Napier, Gisborne and New Plymouth. They ushered in an era of affordable, rapid public transport and fundamentally changed the shape of New Zealand cities. Their speed and greater carrying capacity allowed the growth of extensive suburban areas around the cities. Now we're going to listen to another piece of music now, aptly named Take the A Train by Duke Ellington. There's a sudden end. That was Duke Ellington, Take the A Train. So in practice, streetcars or electric trams and bicycles could cover about 4 miles in a half hour, much slower than the steam railroads carrying executives to their semi-rural estates, but much quicker than the horse car and the human pedestrian. Suddenly, the city itself was no longer limited to a few square miles. And developable areas grew exponentially. A walking city 2 miles in diameter covered only a little over 3 square miles. A streetcar city 8 miles in diameter could cover 50 square miles. It was the first great mass market suburban boom. More American examples: that in Chicago, the development of a comprehensive streetcar and elevated train network allowed Chicago to grow far beyond the pre-industrial limits of cities. Middle-class people could commute on rails and live further from their workplaces. Cities raced to grant streetcar franchises to entrepreneurs, and the industry experienced a boom much like that of the internet in the 1990s. Within a few years, every American city had at least a modern trolley network, biggest cities had a web of rails sprawling outward in all directions, producing an urban topography that defined the turn of the century era, the streetcar suburb. The middle class was no longer confined to the crowded apartment and tenement buildings, and new neighbourhoods sprouted on cheap farmland. They often took the familiar form of a main street lined with shops, with small streets full of single-family homes and townhouses running off that single spine. Doesn't that sound like New Zealand as well? The slower spread of the streetcar in Europe, let alone the rest of the world, contributed to that comparatively compact pre-war design of the cities. Even in European cities like Berlin, that grew quickly in the late 19th century, most new buildings were walk-up apartments. All right, now we're getting into the final two stages of this piece, the underground, in the 1900s to the 1950s. London needed a faster means of transportation. The poor still clustered in extreme density and squalor near their places of employment, in the city centre and docks. But railroads, by then, quite high capacity and frequent, enabled the middle class to spread into an array of suburbs, making London a more low-rise and less dense city than its European neighbours. The problem was getting from the various London train terminals to jobs in London's traditional business district and elsewhere in the central city. Unlike in the poorer areas to the east and the south, buildings elevated viaducts through some of the world's most vulnerable, valuable real estate was just not possible. Charles Pearson promoted an ingenious solution: go underground. The first London Underground line opened in 1863 using steam trains. The route was a sensation, but clouds of smoke made the system a bit impractical, as riders came out covered in black soot. The solution, electricity, helped create the tube we come to know today. In America, it was different. The comparatively new cities tended to develop on a grid of straight roads, which meant trains could sometimes be elevated over the top of the street without the unacceptable curves, rather than buried underground as in central London and most European cities. They call them L trains. They were an ugly solution, but they worked. Cities like Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York covered their streets with steel skeletons, and the trains were soon rumbling above. They carried the growth of New York, for example, up the Isle of Manhattan. If trolleys and streetcars had brought Midtown within a reasonable commute, elevated trains enabled nearly an entire island to be developed. A web of L's spread throughout Brooklyn, connected by the Brooklyn Bridge to Manhattan. After World War II, two dominant planning ideas sought to solve what was seen as the great urban problem: overcrowding. Elevated trains and later subways meant that even the working class could live as far as 8 miles from their places of work and still get there in half an hour. They could afford it too, because many of the systems had cheap flat fares regardless of the distance. The apartment blocks began to thin out, and new homes could be built on land cheap enough for the working class to afford a decent apartment. Those who did flee left room for more businesses, like the skyscrapers that emerged in Chicago around the turn of the century, and the department stores like Macy's and Marshall Fields that occupied the most prominent corners in every city. Along with attractions like the vaudeville and movie theatres, these urban features drew people from miles around, since people were no longer restricted to the close radius around their homes. The combination of technologies created the form of cities before World War II. Dense towns, downtowns, had high-capacity rail transit radiating outwards. Suburbs and elevated trains in big cities, which produced apartment suburbs that were relatively high density, but still much lower than the old tenement slums, and streetcar suburbs with single-family homes and townhouses. Some of the richest people lived beyond, in the small towns on estates, accessible to the central city by railroad. Like many technologies, the car began as a toy for the rich to reach their country estates or to race around on the tracks. As a basic means of transportation, it was severely limited by the high cost and lack of paved roads. That started to change in the US with the introduction of Ford Model T in 1908, which was a mass produced at a price that was affordable to this country's comparatively affluent middle class. Ubiquity of automobile and the enormous government investment in expressways allowed a city like Atlanta to disperse homes and jobs over a large area. And this, of course, as I've spoken before, is what happened in Auckland around the same time. Still, car commuting was not that much more convenient or fast than existing mass transit. Roads built for carriages, wagons and pedestrians soon became severely overcrowded. Cities in the 20s and 30s spread a little bit more than they had when everyone relied on streetcars, especially like Detroit and Los Angeles, where roads were wide and car ownership was highest. But the age of the automobile would have to wait another technology, the expressway or motorway, and the huge infrastructure transformation that adapted the city to the car. After World War II, two dominant planning ideas contended to shape the city of the future. Both sought to solve what had been seen as the great urban problem overcrowding. The first were the towers in the park, famously espoused by Swiss-French architect Le Corbusier, who envisaged replacing crowded old cities with huge skyscrapers. And the other was the idea of Frank Lloyd Wright, of everyone living in what we might call lifestyle blocks, or he suggested one-acre blocks. And what we've seen there is New Zealand, the traditional quarter-acre block. And this is exactly what happened. These quarter-acre blocks, along with the motorways and the cars, became very, very common throughout the new countries, like Australia, New Zealand, and the USA. The cars on the expressways enabled large numbers of people to travel long distances on a day-to-day basis instead of on small railway suburbs where housing was restricted to a short radius around stations. Drivers spread out across suburbs and could now commute 20 miles in 30 minutes. If a streetcar covered 50 square miles, if a streetcar city covered 50 square miles, the 40-mile diameter expressway city now could cover over 1,250 square miles. But, as we know, the expressways reached a threshold, and the downfall is the limited capacity. And we're seeing that in many cities, and particularly Auckland, where we are facing real limitations to just how much land can be given over to roadways. And I've said to you in the past, the six or seven lanes of cars, the number of people it can carry, can be carried in a single lane of rail. And we heard recently how our rail service is now being developed between Auckland and Hamilton. And this is going to change yet again the way our cities in New Zealand look as we start to link up. People may not live anywhere near the city, but having a fast rail service means they can still get to work in close to that half an hour in time. Well, it's been great exploring these things with you. Please write to me, richard@path.net.nz, if you're interested, or send me a text on 021 277 1213. Look forward to seeing you next time. Bye for now.
Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.